It's nearly 8 o'clock in the evening on October 6, 1889. A young artist stands in the middle of an excited crowd on Place Blanche, a small plaza in the suburb of Paris. He's waiting for the opening night of Montmartre's newest open-air café, a place where singers and dancers perform and customers have the opportunity to wine and dine in comfort. The young artist has been looking forward to tonight's grand opening for days. The new venue has been the talk of the town, in no small part because of the eye-catching structure located just above the café's entrance, a large red windmill, or as it's called in French, a Moulin Rouge. The young artist pushes his way through the crowd as a nearby church bell tolls 8 o'clock. He reaches the front just as the Moulin Rouge opens its doors for the first time. The artist pays his fee and walks through the entrance with a flood of customers behind him. The doorway leads into a garden, and there the young artist stops, staring in disbelief at the larger-than-life stucco model of an elephant. The young artist's eyes light up when he sees a scantily dressed woman standing underneath the model. She beckons to the artist and cuts her eyes over to a doorway built into one of the elephant's legs. But the young artist doesn't go inside. He's not certain, but he's heard rumors that in the belly of this elephant is an opium den where one can smoke for as little as one franc. But the artist isn't here for drugs or women. He's here for the show. He's jostled onwards by other customers pushing past him, keen to secure the best tables in the garden with the best views of the stage. The artist joins them, makes his way to a table near the front. As he takes his seat, a waitress bustles over to take his order. With a sheepish smile, the artist asks for a cheaper glass of wine. He'd order something fancier, but he only has a few coins in his pocket. All around him, he hears wealthier gentlemen calling for bottles of champagne, but the young man isn't too embarrassed. He's just glad to be here at all, and grateful he has a decent view for the show that's about to start as an orchestra begins to play. The young artist fidgets in his seat, too excited to keep still. And when the first performance at the Moulin Rouge is about to begin, he and the rest of the crowd leap to their feet and erupt into applause. The young artist doesn't know what to expect from this evening's festivities. All he knows is that he feels like he's part of something special, and that after tonight, the city of Paris will never be the same. When the Moulin Rouge opens its doors for the first time, construction is not yet complete. Among other unfinished touches, the venue is missing its crown jewel, an extravagant ballroom located right next door to the open-air garden. Still, the opening night of the Moulin Rouge is a resounding success. Hundreds of wealthy Parisians sit side by side with artists and craftsmen who live and work in the bohemian, semi-rural suburb of Montmartre. Soon, the Moulin Rouge will emerge as the most famous night spot in Paris. Its name will become synonymous around the world with can-can, cabaret, and controversial risque performers, a reputation the club began to earn when it opened its doors for the first time on October 6, 1889. From Noiser and Airship, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is History Daily. History is made every day. On this podcast, every day, we tell the true stories of the people and events that shaped our world. Today is October 6, 1889, opening night at the Moulin Rouge. It's the evening of October 26, 1890, 1 year after the Moulin Rouge opened its doors. A performer named Louise Weber stands at the side of the Moulin Rouge ballroom, waiting for the MC to finish building up the audience's anticipation for her act. As the Moulin Rouge's biggest star, Louise is used to making a spectacular entrance during each floor show. Normally, she isn't nervous, but today she's about to perform for a man who is heir to the most powerful nations in the world, Edward, the Prince of Wales. A few weeks after the Moulin Rouge's grand opening, construction on its ballroom was finally complete. Now, after 1 year of business, the Moulin Rouge has developed a reputation for its spectacular, riotous concert balls. That's in no small part thanks to Louise and her chanteuses, or the unruly girls, and their new dance known as the can-can. This high-energy romp involves dancers in long, flowing skirts, kicking their legs into the air repeatedly before falling to the ground and landing in the splits. The can-can craze has helped the Moulin Rouge sell tickets, and it's turned the unruly girls into local celebrities. Louise Weber is the most famous of them all. Still, Louise knows that for many conservative Parisians, the can-can is all too shocking. It's not as risque as what goes on inside Paris's many brothels, but the sight of garters and ruffled undergarments is highly controversial. Rumors abound that the powers that be in Paris might try to put the Moulin Rouge and Louise out of business. But that's unlikely to happen tonight, with the Prince of Wales in attendance. Like the rest of Paris, Louise knows all about the prince's playboy reputation. It's quite a contrast to that of his dour mother, the stodgy Queen Victoria. But Louise is a smart woman. Making an impression on the prince would be good for business, so she hopes to win him over with her vivacious routine. Louise's ears prick up as she hears the MC call her stage name La Goulou, meaning the glutton. Louise strides toward the dance floor and demonstrates the trick that earned her the name. She picks up a glass of wine from a customer's table and downs it in one gulp. Louise hears the audience roar with laughter. The dance floor is empty apart from Louise, but the tables and chairs surrounding it are packed with patrons eager to watch the Moulin Rouge's headliner perform. But there's only one patron Louise is thinking about tonight. She squints through the limelights to find the table where 48-year-old Prince Edward sits with his friends. Soon, the orchestra starts to play an upbeat tune, and Louise begins to dance in the middle of the floor. As the music picks up speed, Louise lifts her skirt, allowing her straight leg kicks to reach above her head. She drops to the ground in the splits, one leg in front of her, the other behind, before leaping back to her feet, jumping and kicking in time with the music. She even cartwheels across the dance floor. The audience claps along, cheering every high kick and low split. Louise drops to the floor in the splits again, and the rest of the troupe follow her in sequence, each dancer's splits marked by the clash of cymbals from the orchestra. Then the dancers rise up and turn to face the middle of the floor. They bend over, pulling their skirts over their heads while wiggling suggestively at the audience. The crowd cheers every move, and Louise is thrilled that they're loving the show. Next, the dancers form a circle and whirl around, lifting their skirts and kicking their legs in time to the music. Louise's billowing skirt brushes the tables at the edge of the dance floor, and as she approaches where the Prince of Wales is watching the show, she kicks even higher and shouts, "Hey Wales, the champagne's on you." In the stuffy courts of Britain, it would be a stunning breach of etiquette to speak to the heir to the throne in such a disrespectful way. But in the Moulin Rouge, where the upper classes rub shoulders with commoners, those rules don't apply. Louise whirls onward and glances back. The prince and his friends are laughing, and once again, Louise has proven why she is the star of the Moulin Rouge. The Prince of Wales is delighted, and he leaves the club with a smile on his face, ready to tell the who's who of Paris about this can't-miss experience. The Prince of Wales's visit gives the Moulin Rouge a royal seal of approval, even as the club's performers and patrons push the boundaries of socially acceptable behavior. But as time goes on, the venue's increasingly risque offerings will draw even more attention, until one particular performance is so provocative that it ends in a riot. History Daily is sponsored by Policy Genius. You've probably heard this riddle before. The man who sells it doesn't want it. The man who bought it doesn't need it. The man who needs it doesn't know it. The answer is a coffin. Or is it life insurance? No one wants to need life insurance, and when you need it, it's too late to buy it. But mortgage payments, childcare, and other expenses don't disappear when you're gone. It's one of those things that's hard to think about, but prudent to get right. So at least make it easy to buy with Policy Genius. Policy Genius was built to modernize the life insurance industry. Their technology makes it easy to compare life insurance quotes from top companies like AIG and Prudential in just a few clicks to find your lowest price. And they're not incentivized to recommend one insurer over another, so you can trust their guidance. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $17 per month for $500,000 of coverage. Your loved ones deserve a financial safety net. You deserve a smarter way to find and buy it. Head to PolicyGenius.com or click the link in the description to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's PolicyGenius.com. It's 10:45 on the evening of January 3rd, 1907, 17 years after the Moulin Rouge opened its doors. Tonight, an old man shuffles uneasily in his seat as a hush descends over the crowd in the Moulin Rouge. The old man isn't here to enjoy the show. He's joined a group of his fellow Parisians here to protest this evening's performance. In 1903, the owners of the Moulin Rouge converted the ballroom into a cabaret hall. After the shift, the venue's offerings grew increasingly more scandalous. Dancers, singers, and actors take part in extravagant burlesque shows. One performer, Joseph Pujol, goes by the stage name Le Pétoman. He specializes in breaking wind at will. He uses his unusual talent to blow out candles and even play the French national anthem from his backside. At a recent private party at the Moulin Rouge, students from the National School of Fine Arts allegedly stripped down naked and cavorted around the stage. But to the old man, none of that compares to what he's heard about tonight's show. Part of the evening's billing is a 20-minute play that the old man has been told includes women dressing up as men and kissing each other, a scandal he thinks goes too far, even for the Moulin Rouge. Soon, the curtain rises, and the old man sees an ancient-looking sarcophagus on one side of the stage and an actor in a brown suit reading a book on the other. The old man squints to get a better look, and when his aging eyes focus, he sees that the rumors he's heard are true. The person in the suit is a woman with short hair, Mathilde de Morny, the controversial author of this play. The old man and his fellow protesters begin to whistle, heckle, and jeer, trying to drown out the sound of Mathilde's words. But she continues to recite her lines, even though someone starts a chant, ordering her off the stage. The old man enthusiastically joins in. He stamps his feet to the rhythm of the chant as it grows louder. The sound echoes around the packed auditorium. No one can hear a word of the show. But regardless, Mathilde continues the performance. Soon the sarcophagus opens and a mummy slowly emerges, dancing erotically and shredding bandages to reveal a woman in an Egyptian headdress and jeweled underwear. It's Sidonie Gabrielle Collet, a penniless author turned burlesque performer. The old man has read about her in the Parisian newspapers too. The gossip rags say that both Sidonie Gabrielle and Mathilde have left their husbands and are now in an intimate relationship with each other. The old man sees a woman on the front row fling a wilted turnip onto the stage. It lands at Sidonie Gabrielle's feet, but she just brushes it out of the way with her foot and continues dancing. But soon, other fruit and vegetables litter the stage as more protesters fling items that they've hidden under their coats. But again, the two women press on with their show. The old man watches in disbelief as the play reaches its shocking climax. Mathilde bends down and kisses Sidonie Gabrielle. It's scandalous enough that Mathilde is playing a male role, but the sight of two women kissing on stage is too much. And he's not alone. As the women passionately kiss, furious shouts fill the air. But not everyone in the audience is angry at what's happening on stage. Some are furious that the show is being interrupted. One of these patrons, a well-dressed gentleman in a private box, stands and shakes his fist, cursing at the hecklers for ruining the beautiful piece of art. But the old man can't hear what the wealthy patron is shouting. His words are drowned out in the uproar from the hecklers in the crowd, and some of them make their way up into his box, storm inside, and throw the patron to the ground to silence him. Soon the entire club breaks out in violence. In the midst of the chaos, the old man hears a high-pitched whistle. Police officers rush into the theater and begin pulling people out and onto the street. But despite the riot, Sidonie Gabrielle Collet returns to perform the show the following night, but this time with a male actor in Mathilde's place. Still, the hecklers interrupt the show again, and the theater owners are forced to drop it from the bill. But the riot will make headlines all across Europe, further establishing the Moulin Rouge's reputation for pushing the boundaries of acceptability. In the end, though, it won't be a riot that takes down the Moulin Rouge, but rather an accidental fire that threatens to close the doors of Paris's most infamous nightclub for good. It's 5 o'clock in the morning in Montmartre on February 27th, 1915, 25 years after the Moulin Rouge opened. Marcel Somba, the French Minister of Public Works, rises from his bed. Although it's a Saturday, Marcel is used to early starts and long workdays, even on the weekend. He walks to the window and opens the curtains, and immediately he knows something isn't right. He can smell something burning. He peers through the window into the pre-dawn darkness and can just make out smoke drifting on the wind. Marcel runs downstairs and out into the streets. There, just five doors down, he sees flames devouring the Moulin Rouge. Marcel calls for help, and soon the police arrive on the scene. Marcel pleads with them to extinguish the blaze before the flames reach his own house. They've already spread from the Moulin Rouge to a shop and artist studio next door. Firefighters arrive and use 15 hoses to douse the Moulin Rouge, and slowly but surely the flames die down. By 8 o'clock, 3 hours after Marcel first raised the alarm, the fire is finally extinguished. When the police declare it safe, Marcel picks his way through the Moulin Rouge's entrance. The famous red windmill has survived the fire, albeit blackened by the smoke. But when Marcel walks into the cabaret hall, he gasps. The once dazzling and iconic venue is a mess of charred brick and buckled metal. The roof is collapsed, and the auditorium is sodden with wet ash. Yet the racy can-can and risque cabaret of the notorious Night Spot is not forgotten. In 1921, 7 years after the fire, the Moulin Rouge is rebuilt and reopened. Its new iteration draws performers and customers from around the world. And although originally built to entertain the artists of Montmartre, the legendary decadence and excess of the Moulin Rouge inspires its own stories and works of art. From the paintings of Henri de Toulouse-Lautrec and Vincent van Gogh to Hollywood movies and a musical currently running on Broadway, the nightclub was a place that pushed boundaries, welcomed controversy, and always put on a good show. Beginning when the Moulin Rouge opened its doors for the first time on October 6, 1889. Next on History Daily, October 7, 1915. During World War I, British nurse Edith Cavell is put on trial for treason for helping hundreds of wounded Allied soldiers escape German territory. From Neusser and Airship, this is History Daily. Hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham. Audio editing by Molly Bach. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is written and researched by Scott Reeves. Executive producers are Stephen Walters for Airship, Pascal Hughes for Neusser.